You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 183 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Human Evolution, A Spiritual Scientific Quest. 9 lectures, translated by Simon Blaxland DeLange. This is Lecture 3, given in Dornach on the 19th of August, 1918. Yesterday I tried to give you a picture of the soul being of man. What we particularly want to take from this picture of man as a soul being today are the two boundary zones that we learned about yesterday. The one boundary zone comes about as a result of man's need to come to a halt when he tries to penetrate the outer world as it appears to his senses. Scientists, philosophers, and others speak of the limits to knowledge. We know that these limits to knowledge do not really exist, that they are actually only a reality for man's physical sense perception. The other boundary is the result of everything existing in or entering our consciousness being, in a certain sense, reflected back, mirrored back at an inner threshold, and thereby enabled to become memory. What we have in our consciousness does not enter right into the depths of that region of which man has no more than a subconscious awareness. We shall draw these two boundaries, see diagram, the boundary of memory left, and what we can really call the boundary of the capacity for love, on the right, which is, at the same time, the limit of our knowledge of nature. We indicated these earlier by here, right, drawing lemnis gates that are open to the outside, and here, left, drawing lemnis gates of a different kind, with an inverted loop. So this one on the right is the outer region, which man can no longer perceive with his ordinary powers of sense perception, and is therefore imperceptible. This one on the left is the inner boundary of conscious life, which man is unable to penetrate with his consciousness. He remains with his consciousness above this boundary. Were he to dive down there with his conscious ideas, he would have no memory. Now, in connection with man's soul existence, there is something quite definite that can be said in the light of these two boundaries. If we go back in human evolution, somewhat beyond the 8th century BC, you will recall that the fourth post-Atlantean epoch began in 747 BC. If we go back beyond this period into the earlier post-Atlantean epochs, what lies beyond this boundary, on the right, still in a certain way exerted an influence upon man's consciousness. The atavistic clairvoyance that still existed at that time was indeed dependent on this. Certain impulses from the cosmos were flowing in at that time. And these made themselves manifest as atavistic visionary powers. Hence we can say that this outer domain has become impenetrable, I mean intellectually impenetrable, only since the 8th century B.C., and it has become ever more and more impenetrable. We are living now in the fifth post-Atlantean epoch, and it is now thoroughly impenetrable. People today have become inordinately insistent about this, constantly maintaining that no one is able to penetrate to that, in quotes, thing in itself, as they call it, that lies beyond this boundary. On the other hand, it should be said that another tendency is increasingly making itself felt. And as we approach the sixth post-Atlantean epoch, this will be ever more the case. This is that this zone here on the left will in a certain sense become penetrable. The time will come when from the depths of human nature, a region which I described to you yesterday as an intermingling of spiritual and bodily aspects, and which man should not endeavor to behold, parenthesis, at any rate, not in the way that mystics, who are divorced from reality, would wish, close parenthesis. All manner of things will want to seep through from the sixth post-Atlantean epoch onward. Yes, this time will begin already in the fifth post-Atlantean epoch, in our own epoch. All kinds of things will want to leak through. This will show itself, above all, in that far more people than one would think today will deduce from purely inner experiences that there are repeated earthly lives, for example. Even today, albeit not very often, such insights are beginning to break through. I have frequently mentioned, here and among other places, of a remarkable man of our present time, Otto Weininger, who is known especially for his thick book titled Geschlecht und Charakter, Race and Character. Of even greater interest, however, is that book of his, which his friend Rappaport published after his death, where there are all sorts of interesting things. It consists, for the most part, of aphorisms. The volume bears the title Über die letzten Dinge, concerning last things. One of these aphorisms says something along these lines. Weininger maintains that the human soul may have developed a certain dread of itself in its life before birth, and because of this has acquired the longing to forget this life and bury itself in forgetfulness. And this is the significance of the process of incarnating. Thus Weininger unreservedly speaks about the life before birth, about the process of incarnating, but he speaks in a gloomy, pessimistic way of how the soul seeks to blot out all memory of its life before birth, and tries to achieve this by incarnating in a physical human body. There are many examples of people today who have such direct impressions of the path of the soul, and they will become increasingly numerous. It is possible to see today in a person such as Weininger how the ego is inwardly taking hold of man in what I might call a more solid and compact way. One clearly sees in Weininger's case how this boundary is becoming more permeable, and how all manner of things are rising up from there. It is, for example, interesting to read the notes which he wrote about his own death. When he was still only 23 years old, he committed suicide. He wrote a whole series of notes which are extraordinarily interesting, because they are exact portrayals of imaginations, of astral perception. This was coupled with a certain trait of character which led him one day to rent the house where Beethoven had died in Vienna, and then to kill himself there, the following morning at the age of 23. And the theme of what he had noted down was that he would have to kill himself, because he would otherwise be in dread of being forced by an undefined urge to become a murderer, to have to murder someone else. One can see how the most terrible things are here wreaking havoc in the soul of an extraordinarily gifted man, which cannot be so easily overcome by what is in his consciousness, because there is so much rising up from his subconscious. You will understand that there is a certain justification in indicating that the ordinary cleverness that man is now able to develop is not sufficient in order to know what is welling up from these unknown depths. For it should not be emerging in this way. It should remain below, but it will nevertheless do so. Just as until the year 747 BC something entered in from without, henceforth, something will rise up from within. And this cannot by any means whatsoever be mastered by the cleverness that man will normally be able to achieve. What is needed here is the understanding of the world that can be acquired through spiritual science. It is possible for harmony, inner steadfastness, and inner solidity to permeate man's life of soul only when people begin to want to bring order and harmony to this inner soul life through what can be acquired from knowledge of the Spirit. Human evolution is therefore reaching forward from a state where the outer world was more perceptible than it is today, to one where more will emerge from man's innermost depths than is normally the case today. The things of which I am now speaking are thoroughly familiar to circles of initiates. The whole of Eastern esoteric life, the whole life of the Spirit in Asia, continues even now to reflect that ancient knowledge that was accessible to human beings until the 8th century B.C. Indeed, not only esoteric life, but also the whole of Asiatic culture. This is why it is so difficult for a European to understand when an Oriental, someone from Asia, speaks about his culture. In order to understand these people, one needs to arrive at a certain different way of forming thoughts and ideas. For example, it should be of the greatest interest to a large number of people today to study something as characteristic as the address that the Indian Rabindranath Tagore gave about the spirit of Japan. You will be aware that Tagore is the Indian author who has been awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. He gave a lecture about the spirit of Japan. What he said about this theme is of less importance than the spirit out of which he was speaking, namely that of the modern Oriental, which can be understood only if one knows that in the Oriental something still remains of that in-streaming, dawning light of the outer world, which is no longer perceptible today. For most Europeans, what Orientals say when they are speaking in a way that is in tune with their culture is virtually unintelligible. Generally speaking, it is impossible to understand what they are talking about. And then there is this other phenomenon, that what should really only be appearing in the future is being anticipated. I might compare this with children who, as children, already have the characteristics of old age. They take on these qualities when they are still only children. An irregularity enters into evolution when something that ought to come later is thrust forward into an earlier time. Whereas in Oriental thinking, in the Oriental way of looking at the world, there is especially in the most outstanding spirits something that is left over from an ancient past, in the manner that I have indicated, in individuals who think so completely in accordance with Americanism, something is introduced or thrust forward which belongs to a later time. If one is able to enter into such things, one will clearly see that such individual spirits have within them much of what seeps through here from the left. Readers aside, the left in that drawing, end of readers aside. You get an idea of what is thus seeping through if, for example, you read the essay that Woodrow Wilson has written about the development of the American people, and in particular the North American people. One cannot imagine anything that more hits the nail on the head and is more apt than this essay that Woodrow Wilson has written about the development of the American people. Every word of it gives one the feeling that the whole matter is characterized and dealt with in the shrewdest possible way. And this is particularly striking because in this case Wilson very sharply emphasizes that a large number of people, even in America, hold a view that is justified only if one considers the American people as still representing a dependency of the English people, a view that P. Woodrow Wilson contests. Woodrow Wilson is in the fullest sense of the word opposed to those people who still, today, look upon Americans as if they were descendants or a particular category of English people originating in Europe. And he considers that they understand nothing of the actual development of the American people in the 19th century. For, and here Wilson is speaking out of a quintessentially American spirit with great precision and aptness, Americans only begin inwardly to be Americans at the moment when they cease to be connected in their souls with what came from England. When they start blazing their trail from east to west, from the east coast of America to the west coast. In this trekking through the primeval forests, in the work with shotgun and spade, with horse and plow, in this overcoming of those obstacles in the course of forging the way from east to west, they developed what he calls the man of the West, the, in quotes, Western man. In a manner that makes a direct and highly convincing impression, he describes this way of conquering the ground as the real pulse of American development. In all this, one has the feeling, for in such a case, one must, of course, learn to discern the how and not merely the what, that there is far more standing behind these words than Wilson alone. For when Wilson himself speaks, there's nothing very clever about what he says. What stands behind his words are demonic beings who possess his inner nature, imparting future mysteries of immense magnitude. Mankind would need to penetrate these secrets if evolution is to be understood. It is necessary to make a distinction between the purely scientific and journalistic understanding of the world, one that requires no particular effort and is all too popular, and a true understanding of the world. This true understanding of the world must be able to recognize such contrasting things as I have been discussing here. On the one hand, the capacity of Oriental people to be receptive to something coming from without, see diagram on the right, and, on the other, the emergence in Americans of something that lies within, on the left, what emerges in them is not necessarily to be dismissed out of hand. In a certain sense, it can be construed as a majestic Ahrimanic revelation. For these excellent remarks by Woodrow Wilson about the development of the American people essentially represent an Ahrimanic revelation. The initiates of the East and the initiates of the American people know what it is necessary to make of these things. There is an impulse on the part of each to guide the evolution of mankind into certain channels. The Oriental peoples, or rather their initiates, have quite particular intentions for the future evolution of mankind. These people see what the right path of evolution is and try to influence it to the extent that they are able. They try to give it a certain direction, a certain impulse. And the impulse that the Oriental initiates want to give to evolution is essentially that one should no longer reckon on there being any human generation after approximately the first half of the sixth post-Atlantean epoch. One would give up on the idea of the earthly human race after this time. Human evolution would be brought to the point where human beings do not really any longer have physical descendants, and where souls are spiritualized, so that they cease to descend to earth in bodily incarnations. From the middle of the sixth post-Atlantean epoch, the intention would be to establish for humanity the kingdom of the spirit. This would only be possible if one were to reject certain elements of culture. It is not only the initiates of the East who have a distinctly negative attitude toward certain European characteristics, but every cultured Oriental actually shares this aversion instinctively. And they reject precisely those characteristics of which Europeans are particularly proud. Thus, they have no use for everything that has resulted from the purely technical, material culture in Europe and in its American offshoot. Anyone who studies human evolution, particularly in the 19th century and on into the 20th century, will find that there is justification in saying that technology has made very considerable progress in depriving man of his capacity to work. When it is said that the earth has so many hundred million inhabitants, this is not really quite correct, because one can also reckon how many inhabitants the earth has according to how much work is done. However, it would be perfectly justifiable to say that since the last third of the 18th century, human labor has been carried out by the machines that have gradually been produced. One can gauge, and fairly precisely, how many millions of additional people the earth would have if all the work that is undertaken by machines were to be carried out by human beings. The earth would need to have 500 million extra people. It can indeed be said that there are on the earth not only those people who have two legs and a head and who can be statistically counted, but 500 million more people, if measured according to work capacity. But the labor is being performed by machines. However, there is nothing material that does not have a spiritual dimension in the background. These 500 million human forces represent an opportunity for the equivalent number of Ahrimanic demons to take up their abode in human culture. These Ahrimanic demons are indeed present, and Oriental people strongly repudiate these Ahrimanic demons out of a certain instinct. They don't like them at all. You see, this in every case of a highly cultured Oriental, he rejects this Ahrimanic demonology. For this Ahrimanic demonology gives people a certain heaviness, which rules out the possibility of any fulfillment of the aim of Oriental initiation, namely, that by the middle of the sixth post-Atlantean epoch the human race will physically cease to exist on the earth. Human beings will be held back by what is being developed in this demonically Ahrimanic way. The initiates of Americanism have a different aim in view. Indeed, their goal is a completely opposite one. Their endeavor is to form a more intimate bond than is normally the case in human evolution between human souls and that bodily nature that will be found on earth, the dense, coarse physicality that will come to exist on earth from the sixth post-Atlantean epoch onward. The soul culture will be greatly intensified, but the bodily aspect will be coarse. In the American West, the aim will be to cultivate a closer connection with this coarse physicality than is normally the case, a deeper penetration into one's bodily nature. There will be a reaching toward what is seeping through, see diagram left, brought about by a deeper immersion in the body. Whereas Orientals want to establish a culture where human bodies have no place in the future evolution of the earth, the aim of the American culture of the West is to chain human souls to this subsequent earthly evolution. To the extent that this can be achieved, bodies will be formed in such a way that once souls have passed through death, they will be able to descend once more as quickly as possible into a body and spend the minimum amount of time in the spiritual world. Human souls will be held back as much as possible from residing for any length of time in the spiritual world. The aim is that they return to the earth as rapidly as they can, that they are intimately connected with earthly life. These are tendencies that one must recognize. However strange it may appear to people today to speak of these tendencies, it will be harmful to them if they are overlooked. For it is necessary that they enter with full consciousness into what is required of them, with regard to which they unfortunately often behave in such a way as to justify the remark that they simply allow things to take their course. However, this Western ideal, this tendency to allow demons to hold sway over man, can be attained only if the sole spiritual aspect of Americanism can be supported by another stream, or world conception, that is far more closely connected with Americanism than one might think. As you have seen, the most striking feature of Americanism is its inclination toward an Aramaic culture. But this aspect of American culture would receive a considerable stimulus from another world conception, which is far more closely related to it than one might suppose. This is Jesuitism. Jesuitism and Americanism are two phenomena which have much to do with one another. For at the beginning of the fifth post-Atlantean epoch, it was a question of finding an impulse through which a situation could be created where people were led as far as possible from an understanding of Christ. And the cultural impulse that set itself the task of bringing this about, of completely undermining all understanding of Christ, is Jesuitism. The aim of Jesuitism is gradually to eradicate any possibility of understanding the Christ. For what lies at its foundation is associated with a deep mystery. Man's capacity to receive something from without, see diagram right, into his inner being has always been associated, as I have said, with the atavistic clairvoyance that human beings had prior to the 7th and 8th centuries of the pre-Christian era. Moreover, as a result of this atavistic clairvoyance, they also beheld Christ in the cosmos. The Christ was an object of their perception in the old clairvoyance. I have often pointed this out. I described it in Occult Science, title Occult Science, also known as Title and Outline of Esoteric Science. And the whole meaning of my book, titled Christianity as Mystical Fact, ultimately culminates in this idea. Christ was seen in the cosmos. Christ was seen in the universe. But now consider this. From the 7th and 8th pre-Christian centuries, human beings have lost the possibility of beholding the universe. What, then, would people have lost, if nothing else had happened, through being unable any longer to look out into the universe? What would they have lost? They would have lost the possibility of knowing anything at all about a Christ spirit had the Christ not come down to the earth. At the historical moment of time, when human beings were no longer able to perceive Christ and the cosmos, Christ came down to the earth and united himself with Jesus. From then on, it has been man's task to understand how Christ dwells within him. And some way needs to be found of ensuring that together with what is seeping through here, see the left of the diagram, the Christ is recognized. For Christ has descended to mankind. Jesus is a human being in whom the Christ has dwelt. True human self-knowledge must be the bearer of the germinal impulse of Jesus, so that it will be possible to move on into the future. It is deeply significant that we speak of a Christ Jesus. for Christ corresponds to the cosmic aspect. But this cosmic element has come down to the earth and has taken up his abode in Jesus. And Jesus corresponds to the earthly realm, together with the entire future of the earth. If there is an endeavor to sever man's connection with the spiritual world, he will also lose his connection with Christ. The possibility then arises to make use of Jesus in such a way that the earth continues to exist only in its earthly aspect. You will therefore find in Jesuitism a continual battle against Christology, and indeed a strong emphasis on there being an army for Jesus. It is not surprising that spiritual science should be a means for making these things known, for causing the scales to fall from people's eyes. Hence, those who do not want to be recognized will become increasingly angry about the aims of spiritual science, and the fury grows. The July issue of the Jesuit journal, titled Stimmen der Zeit, Voices of the Time, formerly titled Stimmen aus Maria Lach, contains not only one but two articles against me. And anyone who can link this with new Jesuit aspirations that are developing elsewhere in the world will be able to see something deeper in all this. Unfortunately, however, one speaks of these things mostly to people who are asleep. People love to sleep through the most important things, and to fail to listen to what is actually determining the future. As I said the day before yesterday, everything will come upon people as a surprise. They even want to be surprised. If one speaks at the earliest possible moment about things that are of crucial relevance to the time, people regard this as upsetting. For as worthy members of the bourgeoisie, they would rather sit comfortably in their armchairs for as long as possible, even if they hold responsible leading positions in society. But those who are interested in spiritual science should have it engraved in their souls that everything will be done to make spiritual science ineffective. Above all, it is not exactly a good thing when even we in our circles are only too inclined to sleep where what is going on in the world is concerned. Sometimes it is hard to see that all the personal goings on are given a higher place than what is of such particular importance and significance in our present time, namely attending to the great concerns of humanity as they are gradually unfolding. The attacks which have to do with powerful will impulses come from a great variety of sources of opposition, which need to be taken seriously. Such an attack as the one to which I have referred must in a certain sense be taken more seriously. One has to be able to assess it in the right way. Less serious attention should be given to those snide attacks that constantly well up from the subterranean regions of our society, and which to some extent have an evil aspect, merely because again and again one can observe the tendency for there to be the greatest and most ardent sympathy for those people who malign and seek to denigrate what is striven for in our circles. Only when the harm has been done do people gradually decide to look properly for themselves. But up to now many people have been lionized who have gone on to do damage. I say this not because I think that one thing or another should be different, but because I feel obliged to draw attention to the need for humanity to wake up and to the great importance of our being among those who are striving for the truth. In certain spheres today, more or less anything can be achieved. But the sleep of humanity to which I have referred, which can be overcome only by gaining insight into the spiritual worlds, is extraordinarily difficult to overcome. And with respect to the dissemination of spiritual scientific knowledge, one has to wrestle even more with this sleep than with opponents. I am not referring to any particular instance of this, but in our whole cultural environment, there is something sleepy about the very impulses that are sprouting everywhere from people's heads. Two things need to be engraved in one's soul today like golden rules. Never has there been such a need as in our fifth post-Atlantean epoch for people to make an increasing effort, which I do not doubt that they can succeed in doing, to achieve what is of such particular value, understanding spiritual scientific knowledge. It is true that spiritual scientific knowledge has to be sought through clairvoyant insight into the spiritual world. That is a necessity. It goes without saying that there must be clairvoyance to research into the spiritual world, that there must be those who strive for spiritual knowledge. Secondly, however, it is of particular importance that people are found who are, by virtue of their intellectual power, able to understand this spiritual scientific knowledge, this knowledge that has been sought in supersensible worlds. The rational grasp of spiritual science is vitally necessary today, for it is the means whereby the opposing cultural forces are overcome. Man's intellect today is so vast that the whole of spiritual science can be understood where there is a will. Moreover, cultivating an understanding of this nature is a matter of universal cultural interest and not an egotistical affair. For such an understanding can be striven for if those intellectual forces, which are employed today in scientific domains on all sorts of trivial projects, frittered away in modern economic life and moreover applied in a futile and perhaps even soul-destroying technology, are to be used in a suitable way, so that people are no longer misguided from their earliest childhood onward. One would then see how easily the treasures of spiritual knowledge could indeed be channeled toward an understanding of humanity. This is the one aspect. The other golden rule is this, that something more is needed today if the gifts of the Spirit are to be made fruitful for our culture. The first is something that must be wrested from Ahriman. People today are so clever, for Ahriman sees to it that this is so. And oh, how clever people are! But they apply their cleverness only for materialistic ends. People are not merely clever, they are super clever. We shall speak of this further in the coming lectures, in order that you may see what an immense influence the Ahrimanic element has on the super-cleverness of modern times. But something else is also necessary. Much still needs to be wrested from another spirit. We need not merely cleverness with which to gain a real insight into spiritual knowledge, but we need above all, and with the greatest urgency, the words are barely adequate, qualities of liveliness, enthusiasm, fire, and warmth in those human souls who are the recipients of these spiritual gifts. We need people who can demonstrate the reality of these spiritual riches with the whole of their souls. It is in the realm of the inner life that this knowledge must be wrested from the luciferic powers which are now so active in the world. There is a beautiful vista. It is the picture of someone who, in calm clarity, but with an inner fire and enthusiasm, because it is for him a necessity, is able to engender an inner warmth for this spiritual knowledge. But there is another picture, that of someone who tries to lull himself to sleep by means of this spiritual knowledge, to become dreamy and imbued with warmth, to expand into the forces of the universe and unite his soul with the divine all. These are contrasts that can easily be observed at the present time, contrasts which it is necessary to observe. For it will not be easy to incorporate what we receive from the Spirit into human culture. And yet this must be done. Human culture needs it. People will not only have to learn to think very differently, they will also have to feel and experience things in a different way. Well, I could say a lot more about what I have just said, but I would prefer to stop now, so that you have the opportunity to think about it. There is much food for thought in what has been aroused by deceitfulness of various kinds, which I have deliberately included in the substance of what I have presented. We shall continue to speak of these things when next we meet. The end of Lecture 3.